Okay, so welcome everyone to this session of Marxism 2010 on Obama and imperialism. Just before we start, just housekeeping things, remind people to turn their mobile phones off to silent if they haven't already, and also remind people that if you want to get a hot dinner this evening here, then you have to order it outside after this session's finished during the break, so remember to do that. Now, today's introduction is going to be given by Ashley Smith. He is obviously one of our guests here from America. He's a member of the National Writers Union. He's the Northeast organiser for the International Socialist Organisation and also a member of their National Committee. And as well, he's on the board of the ISR, the International Socialist Review, which is this publication here. Unfortunately, we've now sold out of the new edition of the ISR, which just features articles by Ashley on Haiti, but hopefully we'll have a few more of them in the next few weeks. But in the meantime, here's Ashley to talk about Obama.
Okay, you should clap after I speak, because you have no idea what I'm going to say. I could support Obama. Who knows what happened? So, has Obama tamed American imperialism? I think the best way to begin the question is read what Obama's man really says. Obama's man is a guy named Rahm Emanuel, who's his... is the White House chief of staff, essentially the enforcer in the White House. And this guy is very revealing. He quit the Clinton administration to go volunteer for the Israeli Defense Forces in the 1990s. That's at the heart of the Obama administration. And somebody brilliantly just got an internal memorandum that Rahm Emanuel wrote. And this, I think, describes what Obama's real agenda is all about. This is what the internal memorandum says. I'll read. It's quite long, but I think it's worth hearing. So this is sent about their pre-election strategy, what the Democratic Party wants to do going into the election. So this is what Rahm Emanuel writes. He says, "Democratic presidents historically have engaged in war more than Republicans, and yet we have always been denied the credit. Only by claiming ownership of the current wars can we take away the Republicans' advantage on national security. The Republicans will not argue that wars make us less secure, even if the wars belong to Democrats. They will cheer for the wars, even if the wars belong to us. But no one will cheer for us if we speak about wars as activities we engage in with reluctance." He continues, "It's the economy, stupid. Weapons production is our leading industry and needs to be discussed in terms of job creation and economic stimulus. Think ahead. By 2012, the permanence of the Iraq and Afghanistan occupations will be unavoidable. This cannot be made to appear as a failure or a deception. It must be owned and claimed as a success, a glorious success critical to our national security, and one that former President Bush recklessly opposed by agreeing to complete a withdrawal from Iraq by 2012. It is critical that we draw the comparison between the number of soldiers killed during Democratic wars and the number killed during Republican years, and that we highlight the successes of our innovative use of unmanned drones to kill the enemy without Americans having to die. We must cease shying away from claiming victory in terms of the numbers of enemies killed in the war. We must claim credit for the glory of those Americans killed during our years. There is no funding to be raised by talking about peace. The largest peace organizations did not shut down when Iraq was invaded or when Bush signed his treasonous treaty with Maliki. They shut down in November 2008 because President Obama had been elected. If President Obama tells the remnants of the peace movement to jump, they will ask how high. The Progressive Caucus is completely under control, and its leaders understand that by passing health care, we have created the understanding that we want to care for people at home, but that we must absolutely establish our willingness and enthusiasm about what needs to be done abroad to win wars. And then the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, a strange guy, but I don't have time to go into him, he says, "Democrats' enthusiasm for war is a central element of our plan to create jobs and stimulate the economy. We are working on a program to create tens of thousands of permanent jobs in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and a number of other nations." So much for the peace candidate. So much for the great new hope for ending the wars. In fact, Obama has proved himself every much a militarist as the Bush administration, just a smarter, more talented militarist than the moron George Bush. And essentially, what Obama has done is continuous with the second term of the Bush administration. That's essentially been his policy. And as Rahm Emanuel says, they have no intention of withdrawing from Iraq. This is going to be a Japan-style occupation, a Germany-style occupation, a Korea-style occupation. They are going to stay in perpetuity in the country of Iraq with a residual force of at least 50,000 troops. So they may not even withdraw, depending on the post-election instability that develops in Iraq. And we know the massive escalation that Obama has conducted in Afghanistan that's about to heat up in Kandahar. People saw Obama's visit to Afghanistan to meet with the soldiers to ramp everybody up for the invasion into Kandahar, which is actually a big city as opposed to Marja, which was a fake city that they invaded. If people know this, know the story. They claimed it was a city of 80,000, but it was actually not a city, and there was not a Taliban stronghold, so it was a photo op intervention. Kandahar is a different operation. So they're escalating it in Afghanistan and expanding in Pakistan. As I said in the opening panel, Obama's killed more people in the first year in office through drone attacks than Bush had killed in his 8 years in office. So for all this great pacifism, Obama got the Nobel Prize. We have entered a weird Orwellian world where war is peace, hot is cold, military intelligence. It's like the weird misnomers of the Obama era. So for voters who expected a peace candidate, it's massive disillusionment in the United States, really, with the Obama regime. And it's thrown the U.S. anti-war movement into a crisis as a result. But it was always clear that Obama was going to do what I've described him doing. If you read the fine print of the Obama campaign, because he spoke with forked tongue. Two sides he presented. On the one hand, he said, I'm against the Iraq war, and people thought he meant also the Afghanistan war. So a majority of people who voted for Obama thought he was going to end the Afghanistan war. On the other side, he was very much assembling a militarist cabinet in the run-up to his coronation. So it was very clear. The great lesson is you have to read the fine print, and it's like when you buy things at the grocery store. You have to find where all the toxins are that are listed in the fine print. So Obama came with a lot of toxic materials that most people didn't know about. In reality, the Obama administration's ambition is to rehabilitate American imperialism and to continue to pursue what's been a continuous goal since the end of the Cold War of the U.S. establishing a unipolar world order under its economic, military, and political dominance. That's been the goal since the end of the Cold War, since the collapse of the Russian Empire. And the U.S. U.S. imperialism is now confronting a changed circumstance where it's got growing rivals as a result of the difficulties of the Bush administration, which I'll describe. Because, as we know, for American imperialism, Obama inherited an absolute catastrophe wrought by the Bush administration. Bush really comes to power at the pinnacle of U.S. economic, military, and geopolitical dominance. All the world institutions were dominated by the United States, from the UN, the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank, the regional trade deals, etc. So economically and politically, they were dominant. And as we know, 700-plus military bases all around the planet, the biggest military budget, more than half the world's rest of the countries, their military spending combined equals what the U.S. spends annually. So Bush came to power at the pinnacle of U.S. dominance in the world system, and that was created largely under the previous two administrations, first by Bush 1 and then by the Clinton administration. So he was bequeathed this position of a dominant economy, the Washington Consensus, the re-legitimization of U.S. military domination intervention, the deployment of troops in other countries through the humanitarian wars that especially Clinton conducted in Somalia, Haiti, in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, and in Kosovo. And Bush really oversaw the disruption of that situation of dominance and support for the U.S. And that through the three failed wars that we know about. And that was compounded by the economic crisis that undermined the whole neoliberal consensus, the free market works, Washington should be followed. And in fact, it's increased the ability of countries like China to say, we've actually got a better economic strategy of state intervention in the economy that has meant that China escaped some of the worst elements of the crisis that hit the more free market-oriented U.S. capitalism. So a whole alternative model of running an economy is beginning to attract interest from countries that have gone through the crisis. So Bush squanders this tremendous position of U.S. U.S. power internationally, where countries that had supported the U.S. during the 1990s suddenly are suspicious of what the U.S. was doing. So the U.S. lost the ability to win consent from other imperial powers and lesser nations as a result of what Bush had done. So the European Union is iffy about what the U.S. is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, Russia and China similarly, and obviously countries all around the world. But domestically, Bush's catastrophe undermined support in the United States for the deployment of U.S. troops in foreign wars of aggression, creating widespread opposition not only among the general U.S. population, but also inside the military itself, which is the biggest fear that the U.S. ever had, you know, was what happened in Vietnam when the troops essentially went on a general strike and, you know, fragged their officers and rebelled inside the U.S. military that crippled the war effort in Vietnam. So this was a nightmare scenario that was really developing inside the Bush administration. So the ruling class turns to Obama to salvage the mess that he confronted. And looking at this situation, a lot of people think, well, a lunatic took over the White House. Somehow the neocons, this secret cabal somewhere in the bowels of the establishment, got control of the White House and dictated policy. And it was a big break of the Bush administration from what had gone before. This is, I think, a small L liberal illusion that has been promoted all around the world, and especially in the United States, and it's profoundly wrong. There's really no fundamental break between Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, and Obama. It's a continuous project of U.S. imperialism in the wake of the end of the Cold War, of establishing this unipolar world system. Tariq Ali, in a brilliant piece, I don't know if people have read it, in the New Left Review, he's a brilliant comrade, and he entitles his piece on Obama, he calls it President Can't. And he goes through what, you know, because yes, we can, it was President Can't. So he goes through what Obama's actually done in his year in office. And he has a great summation of the continuity of U.S. imperialism under these various administrations. He writes, "There was no fundamental break in foreign policy as opposed to diplomatic mood music between Bush 1, Clinton, and the Bush 2 administration. There has been none between the Bush and Obama administrations. The strategic goals and imperatives of the U.S. imperium remain the same, as do its principal theaters and means of operation." I think Tariq Ali captures it exactly right. The strategic goal, as I said, is this unipolar world order, a Pax Americana, and the prevention especially of the rise of any rival, any peer competitor like Russia was during the Cold War, or just as importantly, a network of peer competitors. And Bush laid this out very clear in his own national security strategy documents. So Bush the First calls this new unipolar system, the New World Order. That's what Bush 1 established. And their main attempt in the Bush administration was to pursue it through their policy in the Middle East, especially the Gulf War, which I'll talk about in a second. But Clinton takes it up, and one of his apparatchiks, a guy named Anthony Lake, he called the same thing that Bush called the New World Order, he called it enlargement, the expansion of the U.S. sphere of influence into every corner of the planet. Key to asserting the New World Order or enlargement was getting control over the world's most strategic commodity, oil. That's what greases all of world capitalism. Whoever controls that source of the strategic energy reserves can blackmail the planet. If you control that, you can dictate to all your imperial rivals, if you do anything, we'll cut your access to oil. We'll stop the spigot and your economy will die. If you just think about how Russia can blackmail all of Europe because of the natural gas pipelines, they can shut it down and then the European economy shuts down. So the U.S. wanted to do that essentially with all of the Middle East. And that's really what the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein was really all about. When Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, George Bush, the great liberator, goes in to free people of Kuwait and restore the hereditary monarchy, the great democratic mission of George Bush the First. And one of Reagan's apparatchiks, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Lawrence Korb, described what the U.S. mission was all about. He, in a famous quote, he said, "If Iraq grew carrots, we wouldn't give a damn." So it was very clear what they were all about. Carrots are not a strategic global commodity that greases the world system. So oil was no doubt the project. This also, the other part of the New World Order and or enlargement was expanding the U.S. into other spheres of influence, in particular Russia's former empire. So if you think about what both Bush and Clinton did, they expanded the U.S. reach into Central Asia and Eastern Europe. That is, the former areas that had been dominated by Russia in its empire. And they also took aim at the Russian government itself. They wanted to hobble Russia. People have read Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine. It goes through this quite convincingly about how both Bush and then the Clinton administration imposed neoliberal structural adjustment, free market structural adjustments that undercut the strength of the Russian state and made it really a vassal of the United States. That was the ambition, to really incorporate and subordinate Russia. And they did that through various ways, not only the Shock Doctrine, but also NATO expansion, gobbling up new sections of Eastern Europe into the NATO alliance, and also the European Union expansion, to take in sections of Eastern Europe into the institutions that the U.S. Sees as a strategic beachhead to weaken Russia. And they also wanted to do the same kind of thing in Central Asia because of the Caspian Sea natural gas and oil reserves and the pipeline routes. Whoever controls that new center of energy also controls European, Russian, and Chinese politics. So that's what the U.S. was doing in Europe and Central Asia. And they also hoped to lock in their dominance through all the supposed multilateral institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, the UN, et cetera, et cetera. Those were all thinly veiled vehicles for U.S. imperial domination of the world system. So Bush the first initiates this project. Clinton really secured these aims. So there's no break from Bush 1 to Clinton. There's fundamental continuity, bipartisan unity, really, on the question of U.S. foreign policy, of imperial policy. He really led the forging and institutionalization of free market, you know, economics with the formation of the World Trade Organization. That was Clinton's baby project. So he really secures that. And he's the one that really begins to rehabilitate American imperialism with the humanitarian interventions that I listed. And going into Somalia was a catastrophe, but Haiti was very, very significant, Serbia, and then Kosovo, and those are all wars fought under the Clinton administration. And Walden Bellow captures the logic of this situation very well in an essay that he wrote on humanitarian intervention, the myth of humanitarian intervention. He wrote, "You begin with a Haiti or Kosovo, and then you end up with an Iraq. That is, the humanitarian good wars that you can win consent for set up the bad wars that are really the meat and potatoes of American imperialism." Clinton also pioneers all the unilateralism that gets associated with the Bush administration. He was already doing much of the stuff that people say that Bush was in charge of. And you can really see that in Iraq in particular. It's Clinton who pioneers the strategy of regime change. He signs the Iraq Liberation Act, which makes it official policy that U.S. wants to overthrow Saddam Hussein. He's the one who unilaterally says the U.S. will control the airspace of the north of Iraq and the south of Iraq by imposing no-fly zones and patrolling it with U.S. aircraft. And there's tons of other things that the U.S. does unilaterally. So the U.S. is already moving in a direction of saying we will do it even without the fig leaf of a multilateral institution. He also pioneers the policy of imposing a victor's peace on Palestine. That is, he successfully gets the PLO to agree to give up the ghost of national liberation, sign the Oslo Accords, and accept that their transformation into the Palestine National Authority, which is essentially a cop for Israel in the United States over the Palestinian people, and reduces Palestinian national aspirations to being a mere Bantustan in the form that we saw in South Africa. In Central Asia, Clinton also cultivated alliances with all the new dictatorships so that the U.S. can control that region. So he accelerates what was already happening under Bush. And this is very important with Clinton because Clinton begins to go too far. And it starts a logic that then gets played out over the next decade where China and Russia keep coming closer together and seeing that the U.S. is trying to contain their ambitions to rise, in the case of Russia, out of the depths of despond, in the case of China, to mortgage their economic power into becoming a more significant geopolitical player. So as a result of U.S. encroachment in Central Asia in particular, China and Russia start the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That is a political pact between these two powers to stop the containment strategy that the U.S. is trying to impose on those two countries. Clinton also pioneers the war on terror against Al-Qaeda, You know, remember his strike in Sudan against the pharmaceutical factory. That pharmaceutical factory called the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory, that's the one that distributed most of the malarial aid and most of the malarial medicines in Sudan. And so Clinton no doubt led to the deaths of thousands upon thousands of people. So he was already doing a lot of the stuff that we then see develop on steroids in the Bush administration. So Bush the second continued these policies and escalate them dramatically because he's taking advantage of the tragedy of 9/11 to use it for very cynical aims. And, you know, the thing about the Bush administration is that they always told the truth in a blunt, stupid fashion. And so you could read their documents and use them against them, which is what I'll do right now. Condoleezza Rice set up what the U.S. was up to in the post-9/11 period. And you can see the continuity and the extreme that the Bush administration took it to. So she writes, an earthquake of the magnitude of 9/11 can shift the tectonic plates of international politics. The international system has been in flux since the collapse of Soviet power. Now it is possible, indeed probable, that the transition is coming to an end. If that is right, if the collapse of the Soviet Union and 9/11 bookend a major shift in international politics, then this is a period not just of grave danger, but of enormous opportunity. Before the clay is dry, America and our friends must move to take advantage of these new opportunities. This is then a period akin to 1945 to 1947, when American leadership expanded the number of free and democratic states. This is all hype, but Japan and Germany among the great powers to create a balance of power that favored freedom. Now that's a softening. Balance of power that favored freedom. She means U.S. dominance. That's the blunt translation of her little disguise in the quote. So Afghanistan was the beachhead, as we know, into the rest of Central Asia to get those energy reserves and therefore control Russia and China. Iraq was the stepping stone, as we know, to rolling regime change to remake the entire Middle East under U.S. dominion. It was supposed to go Iraq, Iran, Syria, all imposed with, quote, democratic puppet governments that in alliance with the United States, so the U.S. could control the oil reserves and the politics of the Middle East. And Bush bluntly stated all this in the doctrines of unilateralism, the Bush doctrine, preemptive war, regime change, et cetera. But this was all in motion prior in Bush 1 and Clinton. So that explains why Bush won support from most of the Democratic Party. Indeed, most of the Obama cabinet voted for everything that Bush did. Biden, his vice president, Hillary Clinton, his Secretary of State, they voted for Bush's war. Thankfully, Bush's ignorance, stupidity, arrogance bumbled into a disaster in both Afghanistan, Iraq, and then in Lebanon. And we have a great debt of gratitude for the Iraqi resistance that stopped the U.S. in its tracks, really, and prevented the rolling regime change that the U.S. was aiming to do in the Middle East. And then the U.S. loses popular support at home. And then as a boomerang effect of the serious crisis that U.S. imperialism faced in both Afghanistan and Iraq, other powers begin to gain as a result of this crisis that the U.S. goes into. So while the U.S. is bogged down in the Middle East, China goes on a spending spree all around the world, cultivating relationships with African countries, with Latin American countries, outspending the IMF and World Bank in foreign aid. So China sees the U.S. situation as an opportunity to expand its power. Russia does the same thing. Huge increase in the oil prices. They become a petropower, and through their control of the pipeline routes for natural gas, they see a potential to increase their strength in the world system. Then you have regional powers, like in Iran. Iran has been the real victor of the U.S. war in Iraq. That is, its power has increased as the crisis has developed in Iraq, so that Iran, which was relatively isolated before the Iraq war, now has Hezbollah as an ally, Hamas as an ally, whole networks of Shia activists, and the U.S. is bogged down and unable really to get what it wants, what it really wanted was take down Iraq and then get Iran next. That was always very clear. That's why Iran was in the famous axis of evil. You know, first do Iraq, then do Iran, and then even go on to North Korea. So that was their plan. The economic crisis accelerates the weakening of U.S. imperialism dramatically. It discredits the Republican Party as a competent vehicle for U.S. imperialism. And so Bush, in this situation, backs off a lot of his extreme positions. So the second term of the Bush administration is really the first term of the Obama administration. New multilateralism, diplomacy, he's not saying old Europe and new Europe, all that goes out the window. He's trying to cultivate allies, but he really can't do it because he's so discredited. You know, he's got 20% approval ratings at home, and everybody thinks he's a moron. Angela Merkel, when she gets touched, she jumps at, you know, international conferences and stuff. So people were creeped out by Bush. He couldn't really lead the free world, as they say. So as a result, the ruling class turns to Obama to give a facelift to the situation, to salvage the crisis of American imperialism and rehabilitate the exact same project. That's the key thing to understand, the continuous project of securing a unipolar world odor. A world odor, exactly. Yes, like Chavez said of Bush, I smell the devil, you know, when he was at the United Nations. So it's really no surprise because in the history of the United States, really, the A team of American imperialism has been the Democratic Party. It started most of the imperialist wars in the 20th century. That is, the most aggressive imperial political player in the United States has been the Democratic Party. And Obama's cabinet proves the point, really, of continuity. Who's his defense secretary? Gates, who was in the Obama administration. Who are his generals? Petraeus and McChrystal. Who's his White House chief of staff? Rahm Emanuel, the IDF nut job. You know, so you have hard militarists at the heart of his foreign policy advisory team and cabinet, and then you have Biden and Clinton, the most right wing Democrats on the Bush during the Bush years. So Obama's task has been to attempt to put a new gloss, put a facelift on the same old imperial and ambitions, hence the continuity. However, Obama's pursuing this in a changed world situation. That is, with the crisis that U.S. imperialism went in terms of its occupations, and then the economic crisis, other powers have been growing in strength relative to them. So we're seeing a shift towards a multipolar world order. But let's be clear that the U.S. is still the big bully, but it faces real economic and geopolitical rivals. It's obvious with China. The U.S. is in a huge crisis, but China's growing and is an alternative model for economic development, and they're investing in military equipment in a big time way and are flexing their geopolitical muscle all over the place. Russia, even though it went into a crisis, it's mortgaging its oil and natural gas power. The EU, even though it's internally divided, is increasingly independent of the U.S., partially because of its own weaknesses. Because Russia, which controls the natural gas, can force the EU not to go along with U.S. dictates. So the U.S. is no longer in a simple dominant position as it really was in the 1990s. Not only does it have these international rivals, it also have regional rivals that are developing all over the place, really as a result of the neoliberal boom that's gone on. So you have sub-imperial powers like Brazil in Latin America that has now the eighth largest economy in the world, huge commodity producer, and increasingly is exerting its muscle, for example, launching an alternative trade pact in Latin America called Mercosur that's designed to compete and really disable the U.S. trade pact, the free trade area of America. So you have a sub-imperial power in the case of Brazil. Similar things with India that I won't spend time talking about. But India's beginning to flex its muscle because it's also risen as an economic power. You also have reform socialist governments that have ridden the opposition to U.S. economic policy, neoliberalism, all over Latin America. So people know about it. Chavez in Venezuela, Morales in Bolivia, and on and on and on. A whole series of people who rode the back of the anti-neoliberal, the anti-capitalist, the global justice protests against the horrors of the free market to power in elections and now have begun to buck U.S. dictates in Latin America. And you also have, you know, the situation with Iran in the Middle East, a strengthened sub-imperial power in the Middle East. So the imperial and economic crisis really accelerated the process of the development of this multipolar world order. But I do want to underline that it's not like a shift to a real multipolar world order of genuine competing rivals economically, militarily, and politically. You still have one big cop in the world, the United States, which has an enormous lead on every front, economics, politics, and the military. And you have another problem that each of the potential rivals is compromised in various ways. China is dependent on exporting to the United States. So you can't export to your main enemy and really, you know, have a competition. So they're not yet to be in a real rival position. So you've got one dominant cop, a bunch of junior officers, and, you know, potential privates who want to rise up in the pecking order of the global mafia. So that's really what the world system is beginning to look like. So both American ambition to preserve a unipolar world order and plus the growing rivalries amidst the crisis have undermined Obama's ability to put a facelift on the American project. That's really the important thing to understand. In reality, the rhetoric aside, they've been unable to do a lot of the changing of the face of U.S. imperialism and winning back the consent that they lost. For example, in Russia, the hilarious example is when Hillary Clinton went to reset relations with Russia. People know the story. When they translated it into Russian, they got the word reset wrong, and they actually used the Russian word for overload. So that was the thing they gave on the button to Putin and Medvedev. So it's just incredibly ironic that they would make such a Freudian slip, because it is an overloaded relationship, the U.S. and Russia, for example. So they're at loggerheads in a serious way, Russia and the United States, and the fumbling has really exposed what's going on. They've been unable to secure the consent from old Europe. That is, the low number of troops that they've gotten from Europe for the war in Afghanistan is a sign of, I'm not going along with the plan, I'm a little worried about it, even though some have deployed troops to Afghanistan. And the U.S. and China obviously are in a growing confrontation. Nouriel Roubini, the American economist, is predicting a major currency battle between the U.S. and China over the artificially low Chinese currency relative to the dollar. So you can see, you know, big economic battles that are developing between the U.S. and China. And also we've seen the promise of negotiations with Iran go out the window. So the U.S. has Obama has returned to Bush's policy of hard sanctions on Iran. That's what they want. And the threat of, you know, Israel going off the leash and attacking to try and bully China and Russia to agree to the sanctions on Iran. So in essence, Obama has been really channeling the second term of the Bush administration. And his West Point speech on the war on terror, I think, was the most dramatic example. I don't know if people had a chance to watch it, but essentially it was, there's evil in the world. We have a war on terror. We are the forces of good versus the forces of evil. Invocation of 9/11, the horror of the loss in the United States. That is ramping up the old war on terror rhetoric on the one hand, and on the other hand, trying to cloak it in humanitarian terms. We're going to help the Afghan people. We're going to give them a better standard of living. We're going to give them a civilian surge, that was his phrase, of advisors to go into Afghanistan to help out. So really, the Obama administration is faced with enormous challenge of competing with rising rivals and not being able to give it a gloss that they'd really want. So what I want to conclude on is look at three strategic areas where the U.S. and what the Obama administration is up to. In the Middle East, what the U.S. wants to do, four things: salvage the Iraq occupation, isolate and contain Iran by any means necessary, compel Palestinians back to the negotiating table for their endless negotiations that produce no solution for Palestinians, and continue the cultivation of Arab dictatorships as fundamental allies of the United States. And in the case of Iraq, it's very clear. They plan no withdrawal from Iraq. And if you can hear it from Rahm Emanuel. Who knows if we'll even get the withdrawal they promised in 2011, 2012, 2015, 2020. Even if there's some kind of withdrawal, there's still going to be a residual troop force of 50,000. And the other thing that people really haven't looked at is people have heard a lot about Blackwater, like Jeremy Scahill's great book on Blackwater. And it's a brilliant book, but it's only part of the story. The bulk of the private contractors are not military people. The bulk of the private contractors are civilian bureaucrats who are essentially colonial overlords that the U.S. is sending into Iraq to really dictate to the Iraqi government how the Iraqi government is going to run its entire society. So it's really an American Raj of private contractors that is being sent into Iraq to dictate policy economically and politically in the country. And another aspect of what the U.S. is doing is obviously cultivating, and it's part of the Iraq policy, is cultivating the Sunni Arab dictatorships in opposition to the Shia in the Shia power, quote unquote, in Iran and in Iraq. Because Maliki, remember, he's been leading a political bloc of the Shia. So who funded Alawi's campaign in Iraq in the most recent election was Saudi Arabia, pressured to do so by the United States. So the U.S. is trying to use a Sunni bloc against the Shia government of Iraq and also to isolate Iran. That's no doubt what's going on. And at the backdrop of this is Israel. And there's been a lot of atmospherics around Netanyahu and Obama. And the reality is the Obama administration doesn't like what Netanyahu's doing, but doesn't fundamentally disagree at the same time. So what we've seen is symbolic wrist slapping. Don't do that. Bad Netanyahu. Bad Netanyahu. But in reality, if Obama wanted to stop the settlements, they could cut off the aid right away and it would stop because Israel would fall without U.S. aid. So in reality, they support the continued dispossession of Palestinian people. They just don't want Netanyahu to go too far because it could then undermine the ability of the U.S. to cultivate relations with the Egyptian government and the Saudi government because Israel going too far could stir the Arab street and could destabilize the Arab regimes that the U.S. depends on for enforcing things like the blockade of Gaza, because Egypt is a real enforcer of the blockade in Gaza, just as much as Israel and the United States does. So for that reason, they have to keep Israel on a leash, which they have done, Bush did, to prevent an attack on Iran, because it's very clear that Israel wanted to launch an attack a while ago. But the Bush administration and the Obama administration have prevented them from doing that. The other element that I didn't actually mention is expanding the war on terror into Yemen. And this is very important because this is wrapped up in the oil politics. You know, the cover story has been, we've got to do something about the underpants bomber. You know, that was the cover story, the dangerous guy smuggling bombs in his underpants. That's not the real reason they're in Yemen. It's just to disabuse you of that idea. The reality, why they're in Yemen right now, is the strategic shipping routes, you know, that funnel the oil tankers out of the Middle East. There's also huge oil reserves in the south, and so that's why the U.S. is backing the absolutely reactionary regime of the Saleh government in Yemen. The next area, what is Obama up to in Central Asia and in Afghanistan and Pakistan, what he's really doing? First, he's salvaging an absolute disaster that developed in the Afghan occupation because Bush essentially ignored it. And so the Taliban was able to regroup and control up to 70% of the country. So they were losing the Afghan war. So that would be a strategic disaster for the United States. So Obama, as we heard in his campaign speeches, there was the war of choice, quote unquote, which was Iraq, and the war of necessity, which was Afghanistan. So he then went back to the idea of, like, we've got this war on terror that we have to go back and fight in Afghanistan. But really the driving reason is the energy reserves and Russia and China, because the weakness of the United States in Central Asia has meant the relative growth of Russian and Chinese dominance of the area. So they both have material stakes and geopolitical stakes. Ironically, the U.S. attempt to push the war further in Afghanistan and Pakistan has further alienated China and Russia from collaboration with the United States about Iran, because they see the expansionary dynamic of the U.S. into their backyard. And so they've grown closer, forging the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, including inviting Iran to be an observing member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So the attempt to push out in Afghanistan, into Pakistan and Central Asia is further undermining really American ability to dictate not only in Central Asia but also in Iraq as well. In Afghanistan, they're shifting their military strategy. This is what Petraeus was brought in to do in Iraq, and he never did it in Iraq, but that's a whole other story. The shift to counterinsurgency, that is, the humanitarian soldiers who are going to come in and live with the people, you know, develop them, build buildings, deliver aid and water, whatsoever, and win hearts and minds. Sounds ominously like Vietnam, you know, winning hearts and minds. So they wanted to shift to a counterinsurgency strategy because their counter-terror strategy of bombing everything that moves was alienating the Afghan people and driving them into the arms of the Taliban. So their new strategy is, we're going to go in and we're going to win over the people by embedding our soldiers in the Afghan population. The problem with this is they can't break with the counter-terror strategy because they don't have enough troops in Afghanistan. To really do a counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan, the generals say we'd have to have 600,000 troops deployed in Afghanistan. They have 100,000 troops. So this is a photo op counterinsurgency doctrine. And as a result of their weakness in Afghanistan, they have turned to counterterror strategies of bombing everything that moves. That's what they've been doing on the borders of Pakistan and in the areas of Marja. People saw they killed a lot of people with the drone attacks and air attacks and when they did take over Marja. So the whole thing is a mess, really, when you look at what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan. The other thing that they're trying to do, and just like they're doing in Iraq, is install these colonial overlords. So they have huge new civilian bureaucrats that are being sent into the country to dictate terms to the Afghan government. They're building a huge embassy that rivals the embassy that they have in Iraq, which is the size of Vatican City. They're doing just the same thing in Afghanistan, building a huge new embassy and lots of bases. And then the most dramatic thing that we've seen is the expansion of the war into Pakistan. And this has the potential of really destabilizing the entire region and inflaming tensions between India, Pakistan, and the rest of Central Asia and South Asia. And it won't work because the U.S. pressure on Pakistan to go after their border areas, which has been the place where the Taliban has been hiding in Pakistan, actually created the Pakistani Taliban, which is distinct from the Afghan Taliban. So the very attack that they've forced the Pakistani military in has created an opposition that's growing, actually, in the country, in the border areas of Pakistan. Not because people are crazy fundamentalists or anything, but they don't like getting killed. And so they oppose the imposition of Pakistani rule in the area. And that's compounded by the drone attacks that the U.S. is conducting. So they're creating their own blowback situation in Pakistan. And the Pakistani state is being tremendously destabilized as a result. So we're seeing massive instability, massive bloodshed, and horror under the Obama administration, the so-called humanitarian face of U.S. imperialism in Central Asia and the Middle East. And the final area that I want to talk about is Latin America, because the U.S., as I said earlier, has been getting its butt kicked in Latin America by China. Brazil's number one trading partner is China, no longer the United States. That's extremely significant in the region. So the U.S. has lost ground to competitors. Brazil is launching the Mercosur trade area, which are basically a gathering of the South American economic powers. Venezuela has launched ALBA, which is its own trading bloc of reform socialist countries in the region. That is, we're seeing, and Venezuela is developing relations with Iran. That's the other dynamic, and with China. So that network of potential rivals is developing in Latin America, a real threat of a rival axis of power. And we saw that dramatically expressed in the Rio summit in Mexico. People, I don't know if people watched it, but all the 32 nations of Latin America and the Caribbean met in Mexico in the Rio summit and excluded the United States and Canada. That's an unprecedented thing. I don't know if that's happened since the Monroe Doctrine. That is, the U.S. ability to politically dominate is under serious threat. As a result, you can track the increasing U.S. militarism in Latin America. So just begin with the dates. They try and topple Chavez in 2002. They successfully organize a coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti in 2004. And in 2009, the Obama administration, whatever the atmospherics, support a coup against the democratically elected president of Honduras, Zelaya. That's what really lies behind the U.S. military intervention in Haiti. Despite what you've seen on ABC News, despite what you've seen on CNN, if you're subjected to that here in Australia, the U.S. is not delivering humanitarian aid. It's an absolute catastrophe. The U.S. has militarized the aid delivery, really to be the police force inside Haiti to stop those black rioters and all the racist language that they've used, and to prevent a refugee outflow of Haitians into the United States. But that's not the images that we've seen. What we've seen is the great American soldier delivering food and water to the Haitians, and the U.S. Army is now using those images and advertising mechanisms to recruit U.S. soldiers to join the U.S. military for the nasty war. So it's just like Walden Bellow said, first you get Haiti, then you get further expansions of U.S. militarism for obviously reactionary reasons. The big part of that, why they did it in Haiti, was to show that the U.S. would resolve the crisis in Haiti, not anybody else. So it was an exclusive declaration of U.S. domination, and it goes along with an offensive counter that the U.S. is conducting in Latin America. So in Colombia, the U.S. just is in the process of building 7 new military bases in Colombia to launch a counterattack against its decreased ability to dominate Latin America. And that was followed then, after they negotiated that deal with Colombia, with Hillary Clinton running all around Latin America to cultivate alliances with right-wing governments against the bloc of left-wing socialist, the reform socialist governments in Latin America to try and split any potential regional bloc independent of the United States. So what we're seeing really is no peace president, but the attempt of the U.S. out of a position of weakness that the Iraq War and then the economic crisis thrust it into. It's not going to give it up without a fight. It is determined to be the big cop on the planet. So that's what Obama's doing. It's not a betrayal. He was very clear that he was going to do this from the very beginning. He's not a captive to Rahm Emanuel, which is the other thing. The small L liberals in the United States think that Obama has been taken hostage by somebody. Like he's somehow trapped in the White House, subject to lunatics like the IDF or Rahm Emanuel. Really, it's an expression of the deep economic drives of U.S. imperialism to be the dominant power in the world system. That is, whatever the administration, it's compelled to do what it's doing right now. It might have different tactics, strategies, rhetoric, or whatever, but the compulsion to operate in this kind of fashion is driven by the system itself. So I'll just conclude that the left has, I think, an enormous task in the world right now, faced with a world of long-term economic crisis, growing imperial rivalry, and the potential for more and nastier wars. That's what you're seeing develop as I've laid out. So I think it's really beholden on us to rebuild a Marxist explanation of the world system that explains why capitalism produces the imperial rivalries that don't change with elections, that are part and parcel of the system itself. That the world working class should not be fighting these wars, should not be, you know, they should not lose their blood for the sake of oil and empire. And that international unity stretches across borders from the most advanced capitalist countries like the United States to the least developed capitalist countries. That is, we are being forced to increasingly fight wars that are not in our interest. So I think we have to rebuild that Marxist tradition and, most importantly, rebuild, like I called in the opening night, the knee-jerk anti-imperialist left. That is, when the U.S. says it's going to do something, we have to oppose it hook, line, and sinker. It's bad. Whatever the U.S. is up to, it's no doubt bad. And then you have to know your stuff. You can't just say, I'm knee-jerk anti-imperialist and be ignorant. You've got to actually have an argument to explain to people. You've got to know your stuff so that you can win an argument with people who are hooked by the images of humanitarian intervention in Haiti, for example. And we have to build that anti-imperialist left with a socialist core at its heart internationally, because the system is heading us towards more crisis, more war, and we want to fight for a society where there are no drives in the economic system towards war for profit and empire. Instead, we want to build a new international society where the vast majority control the society in the interest of the vast majority to meet and expand our needs and liberate humanity. That's a socialist world future.